usually at 1 p.m. here on WBAI New York. Stay tuned for more programming coming up within this hour. Just as a programming note, Green Street News, The Laura Flanders Show, and Live on the Fly will return at their respective times next week. Stay tuned for the program that's about to air, and it is now 2 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Living for the City, this fundraising edition of Living for the City over WBAI New York. Living for the City is a program focusing on telling stories, our histories, our perspectives of local communities throughout our area and beyond. If you have lived in New York City for any length of time, you know how difficult it is to get the media to report about a subject in depth, tell the truth, or even cover an issue. We examine those very issues, especially dealing with the real estate industry and the very powerful lobbyists. We look at housing, land, air, and water use, including sunlight, and we do so truthfully, accurately, and without any conflicts of interest. My name is Michael G. Haskins. I'm the program host and executive producer, and the senior producer is Jillian Jonas. Before I go further and introduce the show proper, I want to familiarize you to the concept of Sankofa. Sankofa is a word in the Akan Twi and Fante languages of Ghana that translates to retrieve, literally go back and get. And just like the Sankofa bird that is looking back over its shoulder to see where it has come from, we look back in history to see where we've come from, to better understand how we come to exist in this current moment and help us chart a course for the future. And on this day in peace and social justice history, I have a couple of items today. May 24th, 1917, an anti-conscription parade was held in Victoria Square, Montreal, Quebec, in resistance to a Canadian draft to send soldiers to the European War. Riots nearly a year later resulted in the death of four demonstrators in Quebec City. In 1964, on this date, Senator Barry Goldwater, Republican of Arizona, running for the Republican Party nomination for president, gave an interview in which he said he would consider the use of low-yield atomic bombs in North Vietnam. On May 24th, 1968, four protesters, including Phil Berrigan and Tom Lewis, were sentenced in Baltimore, Maryland, to 6 years each in prison for pouring blood onto draft records. In 1971, on this date at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, an anti-war newspaper advertisement signed by 29 U.S. soldiers supporting the Concerned Officers Movement resulted in controversy. The group had been formed in 1970 in Washington, D.C., by a small group of junior naval officers opposed to the war. The newspaper advertisement at Fort Bragg was in support of the group's members, who had joined with anti-war activist David Harris and others in San Diego to mobilize opposition to the departure of the carrier USS Constellation for Vietnam. No official action was taken against the military dissidents, though many were forced to resign their commission. And just one final note. In 1981, the International Women's Day for Disarmament was declared, calling for the peaceful resolution of conflict and an end to the horror and devastation of armed conflict. And that will conclude our Sankofa moment, looking back in history, peace and justice history that I open the program with each and every week. Today we have 2 hours, 2 hours for Living for the City. Now, I usually, myself and senior producer Jillian Jonas, we have a number of things that we share with you from all around the city. You talk about housing and real estate and the community fight back, the organizing around such. People struggling to continue to live in the cities that they, in many, many, the overwhelming majority of cases, help to create and build into what it is now, and in so many cases being forced out. So we bring these community groups and organizations onto these airwaves, onto Living for the City, to talk about these stories. But we're going to look back in history now. This is part of Sankofa as well. I talk about the telling of stories, and if you've listened to me any time for the past 10 years or more, I am always talking about and wanting to look back in history, the history of my own family, and the history of people of African descent, in particular, there's our sojourn in this country. Well, we're going to go beyond our local communities today, but not really, because it's all related. It's all connected. Let's say we're going to be out of the New York metro area today. Our focus is not going to be the metro area. We're going to New Orleans, Louisiana, and look back in history to what many historians have called the largest slave revolt in U.S. history. A revolt of enslaved Africans. And there is a detailed story about that particular revolt and all of the revolts here in the United States. But what we're going to do right now is to bring you some of the curated audio that I have, past interviews, and bring that to you to give you a picture of what we're talking about. And what we're talking about is the 1811 slave revolt in New Orleans, Louisiana. Had you heard about that? Do you know about that? Maybe some listeners who have been tuned in for some time are familiar with it. Many I would imagine are not. Some of you are not, or hearing about this for the first time. The largest slave revolt in U.S. history. So we're going to go and talk to the recreation artist known as Dred Scott. Just a moment.
The state of Louisiana has memorialized the largest rebellion of enslaved people in U.S. history with a road sign. I'm glad that there is a sign that marks it, but I also think that to mark this most magnificent event with a sign in a traffic island, you know, by the side of a highway, that's crazy. Other people have tried to sort of mark this event, often focusing on the brutality and the suppression of the rebellion. And what I'm interested in is the liberatory aspects of the people who were fighting to free themselves.
WBAI New York. This is Living for the City, and I'm Michael G. Haskins, your host, and thank you so much for tuning in. And speaking of thank yous, I certainly want to thank once again the folks at Revolution Books for providing this audio. And in studio with me this morning is the artist Dred Scott, and he's the creator of the 1811 reenactment. And we're going to talk about the reenactment and how he approached this idea, what encouraged him, and what spurred him on to do this. We'll get to that, but I wanted to start with some of his history and some of his ideas around using art in this way. So with that, I'd like to welcome the artist Dred Scott to WBAI once again. Dred, good day. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to have the conversation with you today.
Absolutely, as am I. Dred, let's start before we get back or go back to the reenactment. And I'm hoping that I can play some additional parts of this, not from this, but from my own archives of conversation with Leon Waters and Earl Caldwell. Let's talk about your history and your using art in this very, very creative way. Talk about your history and what you've done over the past.
Yeah, well, you know, I tell people I make revolutionary art to propel history forward. And, you know, the basic premise that I have is that you know, the world as it is a horror for the great majority of people. You know, they're, you know, half the planet's trying to survive on less than $2 a day. And there's a tiny handful of people that controls the great wealth and the knowledge that humanity as a whole has created. And it doesn't need to be that way. And we don't have to live like this. We actually need revolution here and in large parts of the world to get to a world where people would actually, you know, enjoy and be, you know, fully emancipated human beings and flowering human beings. And so, you know, the work that I make actually talks about some of the big questions confronting humanity. And often it enables people to imagine, you know, the world, not only see the world the way it is, but also to imagine how it could be radically different and far better. And so an early piece that, you know, I made that sort of introduced me to the national sort of stage or spotlight was an artwork called What is the Proper Way to Display a U.S. Flag?
Mm.
And that work was made in 1988, and it became the center of national controversy in 1989. It was, you know, when people, you know, when I tell people I'm an artist, a lot of times I think, oh, he must be a painter or something like that, or they've, you know, just heard about the slave rebellion reenactment, so they might say, well, he's like a performance artist or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I work in a lot of different media, and What is the Proper Way to Display a U.S. Flag was what I call an installation for audience participation. Most of my work exists in galleries and museums, and this was one like that. And so it had an image on the wall, a photo montage that had words, text that said, what is the proper way to display a U.S. flag? Below that, text was pictures of South Korean students burning an American flag, holding signs that said, "Yankee, go home, son of a bee." And below that was flag-draped coffins coming back from Vietnam in a troop transport. Mm. And then on the wall below that photo montage was books that were originally blank that people could write responses to the question, what is the proper way to display a U.S. flag? And below that was a 3-by-5-foot flag on the floor that people had the option of standing on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could approach the work and write in the book without standing on the flag, but a lot of people stood on the flag. And so this was...
And wrote their responses there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And mm-hmm. so the responses varied. I mean, some people, you know, said, look, I should be shot and my family should be made to pay for the bullets, but once again, what do you expect from a nigger named Dred Scott? Mm. And other people wrote, you know, look, the flag stands for everything oppressive in this system, and, you know, they talked about how their family members were killed by the police, and that the police kicked over the body of the person to make sure the N was dead, and then said, look, that cop wore a flag on his arm, a patch of a flag. Mm. Thank you for the opportunity. So mm-hmm. it put those voices, people, the voices of people who feel oppressed yeah. and exploited yeah. and victimized by America, on an equal footing with the George Bushes of the world to talk about what the U.S. flag and what U.S. patriotism represents. And so people came to see this work when it was on display at the School of the Art Institute, where I was an undergraduate art student at the time, and they sometimes waited in line for as long as an hour, and it became this whole controversy where there were demonstrations, there were bomb threats flown into the school. You know, students that were other black students, you know, got somewhat roughed up by white racists who, you know, thought that it was me. And it did ultimately get to the point where George Bush the first publicly called the work disgraceful, which I thought was a tremendous honor that mm-hmm. the president of the United Indeed. States knew I existed and yeah. didn't like what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, this is a good job. Yeah. I want to do this for the rest of my life. Congress ultimately outlawed the work, which was about more than just this artwork, but it really did show the power of art. And when you look at, you know, there were people that would call into talk radio shows that I would do at the time. And this was in 1989. Mm. And, you know, there were people from the ghettos and barrios from sometimes as far away as, you know, California or Texas or New York, because this was in Chicago at the time. And people would talk about not only how they thought about it as politically something they were, you know, inspired by, but also they would give art criticism, and particularly like people from the housing project in Chicago. And at the time, like 10% of the black population in the city of Chicago lived in public housing.
Interesting.
And they were coming down to see an artwork by a previously unknown art student. Mm-hmm. That was a conceptual artwork. It wasn't even a painting, which people are more familiar with, but it was this unusual art form that people thought, this is about us. We have something to say about this. And we actually want to engage this artwork. We want to see it, but we want to include our voices in the conversation. And it was a really, you know, inspiring time for me to have all sorts of people, including people who, you know, were more sort of in the middle on mm-hmm. the question. Mm-hmm. You know, like a German woman wrote, you know, we Germans, you know, you guys in America care too much about your flag, carry on too much about it. If we Germans carried on about our flag the way you all do, we would be called Nazis again. Right, right. And I think that's really insightful from somebody who doesn't live here to looking at the outside and saying, look, this is kind of fascist what's going on. And so this piece was made in 1988, is, you know, became the center of controversy in 89. And I think you look at what's going on right now, where there is a real drive towards fascism led by Donald Trump and Mike Pence. But, you know, I mean, even, you know, just this recent impeachment trial where they said, look, why would we have witnesses and evidence? Why would we want that? That would kind of ruin yeah, things. This yeah. is about power, and we're dictators. And yeah. so
I'm speaking with Dred Scott. He is an artist, and the way that you have approached art, it is so... It's wonderfully inclusive to hear you talk about the people in Chicago that really don't have a voice regularly, but giving them the voice so that they can express their feelings and what this art presentation that you had created meant to them and others, people that are not nationals of this country. It sounds very, very interesting and quite intriguing, actually. You did that piece, and that kind of thrust you on to the national stage, but you're an artist. You're yeah. a working yeah. artist. Mm-hmm. Where did you go from that point? I know that you had done some art presentation, some work around lynching, and, yeah. and that I don't—it's not—it's not dear to me, but it's something that I've been very interested yeah. in since around that same period of time, since 1988,
yeah.
when I myself and my late colleague Dred Scott Keys created this piece called Lynching, an American Tradition, and it was just interesting to me to find out that you had worked in this area and doing some similar things. So take us there and what you did around that.
Well, I mean, the first thing, just in terms of history, is like I was an art student in Chicago, and then I hit this sort of big time in a certain sense. I said, well, I got to get to New York. And it's like, you know, Chuck D was doing Fight the Power out here, and you know, this is where it was happening. So I moved to New York, and, you know, lo and behold, it's like I was a big fish in a small pod. I'm just a little guppy in a big sea. But, you know, it was definitely the right thing to do. And so, you know, I started to, you know, continue to figure out how to make this work that kind of served the people, that talked about big questions confronting humanity, that, you know, helped, you know, contribute to creating a movement for revolution as art. And so the piece that you're talking about lynching, there were a couple of them that I did in the 1990s, actually. One I did in 1998 that actually had that was actually talking about sort of how the police are, frankly, the inheritors and of you know, lynch mob terror, how state violence and the death penalty really is a continuation of lynch mob terror. And it had a picture of a black man on fire with a crowd of white onlookers, including children, you know, which is these lynching, you know, was not this rare occurrence. It didn't happen every day, but there were 4,400, you know, racial violence lynchings that happened in the United States from 1865 to 1965. And it was a form of terror that most black people obviously weren't lynched, but all of us knew that we could be lynched.
Could be.
For any reason or no reason whatsoever. And that for some white people, this was sport. This was a picnic. This was an event. You know, who would bring their child to see a violent torture act and murder? Well, lots of white people did. And so there was a photograph of, you know, a black man on fire with, you know, a crowd of white onlookers. And then in front of that was an electric chair, and surrounding that were these, like, head beaters, what I called them, as mechanized police batons that would beat down on the top of a skull cap, basically, it was. And then there were photographs of black and Latino men in prison, effectively. I mean, they weren't actually people that were in prison. They were ordinary people out on the streets, but they were framed in a way that looked like they were imprisoned. And then there was a police radio that played live, unedited police reports of whatever was going on in the area. So it was really connecting that history of racial violence, lynching, to the present of you know, police brutality and state violence with execution. And then I did another work about the dragging death lynching of James Byrd that happened in Jasper, Texas in 1998, and I made a piece in 1999, that basically sort of abstracted that horrific event as a public sculpture. It was a sculpture that was installed at Socrates Sculpture Park, which is in a highly diverse neighborhood. It's a public park in New York City, in Long Island City. And it basically had a 50-foot roadway surrounded by 5 telephone poles. There was a truck bumper that was on the roadway, and there were 500 feet of chain that went from that truck bumper to the tops of these telephone poles. And then mixed in and amongst all that was hundreds of bones. So in these and slave collars, you know, leg irons. And so that was, again, this talking about this past and the present at the same time, looking at the history of enslavement, but also how modern day in 1998, you know, white supremacists would just frankly for sport almost drag a man to his death, brutally killing him over the course of 3 miles of being dragged behind a pickup truck.
One has to just pause when I think back on that, when that first came to our collective conscious, think about the brutality. Well, I'm speaking with Dred Scott, the artist, and we're going to be talking about the reenactment. I played some excerpts thanks to the cooperation and collaboration with Revolution Books. Some of that audio and some audio from my own archives with Earl Caldwell. Now, Dred, you've taken us through some of your history, just a small portion of the history and your involvement in art, in presenting art in this way, this creative way, bringing the people right into the art. Now, speaking of bringing the people into what you're doing, how did you get into deciding to become, and we heard part of this from Revolution Books, from the clip that I played of Revolution Book, but presenting to the community down in New Orleans that you wanted to do this recreation. Maybe many did not know about it. And take us there and what happened and how you pulled that together.
Yeah, well, in 2013, probably about 2011, I had this idea. I would love to do a slave rebellion reenactment. As an artist, I'm always thinking of ideas, and some of the ideas, you know, just make it into a notebook or in a computer file. Some of them, you know, don't even get there. The ones that make it into a computer have a chance of existing, and you think about them. And in 2013, I was invited to come down to Charlotte, North Carolina. They have a thing called the McCall Center, which has a residency for artists, and they invite you down to come work on a project for 3 months. And I said, all right, I'd love to come down there. That'd be great. And they said, you know, it's a project-based residency. You have to tell us what you want to do. So I looked at my computer and I said, oh, yeah, I had this idea. I'd love to do a slave rebellion reenactment. And, you know, I'm probably not going to do it in Charlotte, and I'm probably not going to do it during the time of the residency. Mm-hmm. So I expected they would say no. And so they called my bluff. They said, that sounds like a good idea. I'm like, damn, now what do I mean? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? What is a slave rebellion reenactment? And a lot of the way I think is, you know, what, you know, when I'm thinking about art, what doesn't exist. So art is a creative process. So if something already exists, you don't need to create it. It's already been done. So what doesn't exist? And then I think, why doesn't it exist? And then I think, should it exist? And so with the slave rebellion reenactment, it's like, I hadn't seen one of those. And then I kind of know why they don't exist. If I ran this country or had a lot of unity with the ideas of governing ideas of this country, I wouldn't want to tell people about the history, not only of this country and its brutality towards the people they enslaved, but that people fought back and rose up and were trying to get free. Right. And so I was like, all right, this is kind of a good idea. I should do this. And then that meant I had to start doing some research. And it turned out, you know, and I know a fair amount about the history of slavery and enslavement in the United States. And I know a bit about, you know, slave rebellions. And somebody told me, the interim residency director said, you know, what about this revolt in 1811 in New Orleans? And I'm like, well, you know, I don't think so. I know a lot about this history, and I don't think that exists. She said, no, I just heard somebody talking on public radio about it. I'm like, what are you talking about? So she had heard somebody talking on NPR. It was this guy, Daniel Rasmussen, who'd written this book. I was like, well, I got to go get this book. And so I was like, oh, wait, this is really interesting. This history is buried. And in that book, Rasmussen talks about On to New Orleans and this guy named Leon Waters. So I'm like, well, if that's the guy that really is in the know, I got to go meet this brother. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I went down to New Orleans and I started looking for Leon Waters. And he was a little hard to find. Mm. And then I met him and it was like, oh, yeah, that Rasmussen book, that ain't no good. I'm like, what you talking about, Leon? What is it? So like, look. Here's my book. It was published. I published it. It was by, you know, Albert Thrasher. You should read that and then read the Rasmussen book and compare them. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This Rasmussen book, which was a New York Times bestseller and got him on a tour of the talk radio and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was basically, you know, plagiarized might be a little bit strong, but not necessarily that strong. I mean, Rasmussen's book couldn't exist without On to New Orleans. On to New Orleans is the primary scholarship and research. And so when talking with Leon and you read this book, and I agree with you, there are problems with On to New Orleans, but it's actually a really good book. So he had a sort of family member who, when he was a young kid, he was like 10 years old or 12 years old, a family member, a much older cousin, who was about 80 at the time, said, you know, look, our ancestors fought against slavery. But Leon was 10. What do you do with that information when you're 10? Mm-hmm. Leon gets older, and he becomes a revolutionary, and he tells some of his friends, and his friends said, dude, if that's at all true, we got to find that out. So they start doing the research. They find, you know, tribunal records for when this rebellion was put down that were in French, and they got some of that translated. They found insurance claims for when the enslavers murdered the people that rose up. They filed claims and said, look, we got to get our property back. They found correspondence between the governor and the general. Yeah.
That's right.
They found newspapers from as far away as London and New York and Philadelphia. So the biggest slave rebellion in the history of the United States was basically buried and covered up. But here it was right here. And so these guys, Albert Thrasher, Leon Waters, and a couple other people did this research, and they self-published this book, which is On to New Orleans. And it's really amazing. It actually sets the history of, you know, the transatlantic trade in people that talks about the relationship of Haiti.
Haiti.
And, you know, I mean, you were really, really right to point out, it's like the enslavers didn't just say, like, all right, we're done. They're like, well, man, you know, if this factory's closed down, we got to go find some more land, more factories, and set up someplace. And one of the people, they, places they came to was New Orleans. And, you know, it, since it was already at the time a French colony, they were like, look, we basically, we have passports. We could go set up there. And lo and behold, the weather is warm enough that we could grow sugar there. Right. So the main crop that enslavers were, you know, forcing people to grow prior to sort of the Haitian Revolution was indigo. But sugar was much more profitable. So they said, like, clear out this dye stuff. Let's get some sugar going. That's where the real money is. And so they set up operation in New Orleans. And they brought a lot of people they enslaved with them. And they enslaved new people. And so this book, you know, lays that history out in a really good way. It talks, and they're primary, they're, you know, reproductions of primary source material. Yeah. So that, look, if you don't believe what Albert Thrasher has to say, here's all the, you know, here it is in black and white from you know, all the these historic documents. And then also one thing that's really valuable is there are a lot of runaway slave ads. Because a lot of times people, you know, in this country, if you grow up in this country, you don't actually learn the history of enslavement and resistance. And so they print, like, hundreds of runaway slave ads to show that people were not just, like, happily being subjected to enslavement. They were trying to get away. They were trying to get free. And also they were, you know, poisoning and fighting back and And so, you know, the book is, I would really encourage people to get the book, and especially, you know, now if it's being offered as a way to support WBAI, that would be a really good thing to do. But I, so when I was, went down and met Leon, and this became kind of my source book, because it was really the source material for constructing a slave rebellion reenactment. And the other thing that is kind of revealed in here that's really important was that the aims and goals of this rebellion was not just to get revenge, which would have been righteous. I mean, you know, it's like if you're enslaved, you know, killing a couple of enslavers, that'd be righteous, that'd be cool, but that was not the goal. They wanted to set up an African republic in what is now modern-day Louisiana, then was the territory of Orleans territory, and set up an African republic that would have outlawed slavery much the way it was done in Haiti. That was a really radical and bold vision, and that's why I said this is the reenactment that needs to be done. It had this lofty vision of getting free. It was unknown and buried history. It was the largest one in U.S. history, and it could have changed U.S. and world history. And so imagine if there is an African Republic in 1811, you know, in New Orleans, if that happens, would other enslaved people throughout the rest of the Lower South have risen up? Would Texas have seceded from Mexico? Would other, you know, U.S. colonial westward expansion have continued if that happened, you know, if Texas doesn't secede? If, would California have been part of the United States? I mean, there, all these changes would have happened if this was like a beacon of revolution and change right on the borders of the United States. Now, I'm not a historian. It's entirely possible the U.S., you know, would have said, okay, we have to invade and put this down. But, you know, it's also possible that history would have played out differently. And so I wanted to reenact this and bring a vision of freedom and emancipation of, you know, the Slave Rebellion reenactment was a project that brought hundreds of black people, about 300 to 350 black people, with machetes and muskets and sickles and sabers, marching to the outskirts of New Orleans and in the city itself, chanting, on to New Orleans, freedom or death, we're going to end slavery, join us. It was a project that was both honoring and sort of lifting up this history and this past, but it was also about the present. We were.
Can you imagine that? And can you visualize that in the outskirts of New Orleans, Louisiana, a few years ago? That was Dred Scott. He is the recreation artist who created the representation of the 1811 slave revolt in New Orleans, Louisiana. Part of the audio you heard was from a talk that he gave at Revolution Books a few years ago at 132nd Street and Malcolm X Boulevard in Harlem. Part of it was the representation itself. But this is the end of the story, really. The story begins, for me, several years before that, and this is WBAI's Living for the City, an expanded edition of Living for the City. We're on for 2 hours today. We're raising funds for WBAI. We have some books to offer as incentives and thank you gifts to you for supporting WBAI. I will give the pledge line number out right now. It's 212-209-2000. 2950. And we have some books offered. There's a $60 contribution, but I'll get to that in a minute. But as I said, the story begins several years before that. One mid-November, I believe, coming up on the anniversary of the 1811 slave revolt itself, which is January 8th, if I'm correct. I believe it's January 8th. Earl Caldwell and I used to come uptown together after the Caldwell Chronicle on Friday evenings when the station, WBAI, was located on Wall Street. And we would pass, we passed by a bookstore, and he said, "See this book in case, displayed in the case? Michael, we should check this story out. Stories about the insurrection in New Orleans in 1811. And by the way, this was the Rasmussen book that Dred Scott was talking about. It's not Leon Waters' book. It's the Rasmussen book. But stories about the insurrection in New Orleans in 1811 is a significant date in the history of this country because the country was very young then. The Lewis and Clark expedition had just happened. Remember that from your history when you went to school? They still teach that, right? Yeah. Lewis and Clark expedition. The Haitian Revolution had just culminated a few years before, 1804. All these things didn't come together at that moment in my mind, but we both read the book, Earl and I, with keen interest and said, we've got a story that we could bring to the Caldwell Chronicle on WBAI, and we did. We brought that story. But we found out that there is an even deeper story than we initially found and we really suspected at the beginning. Well, joining me this morning is my friend and colleague, longtime New York City journalist Earl Caldwell. For those of you who do not know, it was my pleasure to produce the Caldwell Chronicle broadcast on these Pacifica radio airwaves more than a decade ago, and I am pleased to have him with me this morning on our Living for the City broadcast. Earl has just finished a long stint at Hampton University in Virginia, where he played a prime role in getting the spanking new Scripps Howard School of Journalism and Communications up and running and doing a lot of good things on that historically black university campus. Earl tells me he is knee-deep in his memoirs project, but he says he's also writing about his experience in creating a new age journalism school in this wild and changing time in the media. So, Earl, great to have you with us this morning, Earl.
Michael, it's my pleasure to be here. Just I'm listening to the broadcast, and it just brings so many chills because it takes us back to that period in those days when we were discovering this. But one of the things I'd just like to say is that so much of news now, it's not people reporting and getting information and bringing it. It's opinion. You know, even in sports, everything is opinion. In this story that you are focusing on this morning, for me, the key point in everything was we were talking, we were excited about all of this stuff with Rasmussen and everything, but at the key turning point was you got on a plane and went to New Orleans and met Leon Waters and got all that firsthand reports, brought it back to New York and brought Leon to New York and introduced him on WBAI to the New York audience. And this, I mean, this history is so powerful. It is awesome. But I just think that for us, the turning point was your, what you say as reporters, using shoe leather, going to New Orleans, yeah, finding these things, talking with these people, and you know, that energizes you in a way that you can't even explain.
Right. Well, you know, Earl, the compelling thing about it is, as you say, we knew that we had stumbled, really, on something really important with the story in and of itself. But the name of that book, and I don't know if it's still in print, it probably is, it's called, by Daniel Rasmussen, called American Uprising. And it was, a production, I think, of HarperCollins published it, and it got a lot of press. Harvard University was behind it and all of that. And we were very interested in the story because we hadn't heard about it. You've been around longer than I have, focusing on these and other issues. I hadn't heard about it, and I've been here at WBAI at that time about 20 years or so, and I've been around people who, you know, that's their raison d'etre, is history. I hadn't heard that. I hadn't heard that at that point. And so when I saw in that section of the book, it's about 1.5 or 2 pages, that mentioned Leon Waters, this Vietnam veteran, and this Hidden History Tours, that's what's called, Hidden History Tours, down in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I went down there, Ginger and I went down there a few years after, and I reached out to Leon Waters to actually got in touch with his cousin first and talked to him and expressed my excitement and interest for Leon's book, On to New Orleans, because I saw his name. I said, this is the guy, as you heard Dred Scott say, this is the guy I should be talking to. I want to talk to Leon Waters. So when I finally get to Leon Waters, he didn't want to talk to me. He did not want to talk to me, and he was not interested in doing any interviews because he had been burned before by the experience he had with Mr. Rasmussen. So he said to me, if you want to do an interview with me, get my book first. And I did. I got the book, got a couple of copies for both of us, and we were stunned. And you know, you can see the book right away when you start reading it. This is a community effort. I'm going to say something about community. I've been reluctant to mention community in the same breath that I do my beloved radio station because, you know, I'm feeling some kind of way about it. Justifiably so, in my opinion. But when things like this happen and, you know, we can make these connections, then I feel really good about BAI as a community radio station and want to get back to more of that. But in any event, that's really an aside. We read the book, On to New Orleans, and said, we have to get Mr. Waters here in New York. We can do, and see, at that point, Earl, and this is important, at that point, we're going back to, what was it, to 2010, or 2009, 2010, I think, it hadn't been publicized. Dred Scott hadn't done the recreation event. That hadn't happened yet. So this was unknown. But we brought it up here, and I have to say, the WBAI audience really responded in a tremendous way. And, I mean, am I wrong in that, Earl?
No, you're absolutely right. It lit a fire, and it was raging. And, you know, the truth has its own way of connecting. It's authentic. The people on the WBAI audience, they knew right away, this is what we've been waiting for. And this Harvard, Henry Louis Gates was the major promoter of this book. They had the money, they could do these things, but they sanitize it. They take it and change it in a way that it has a different ring to it, a different Leon Waters was the real deal. And when you brought that piece into it, the audience responded in a way, like in all of my years there, that, you know, our broadcast was on for a decade. Nothing hit the airways and drew that response that came from this. And I'll tell you, after 20 years of dealing with students at the university, I still say to people, you want to give your son or daughter something that's important? Give them a copy of this book, because it has, it's just chock full of authenticity. Michael, I tell you, some nights I just like to just read. It has these, you know, like you were saying, the slaves were in a constant rebellion. They were running away, doing everything. But the things that these slave owners were doing, I mean, it was talking about this Haitian man not only killing the people, cutting them apart, stuffing them in animals, and doing, I mean, things that you could, I'm saying, well, how could you even get this stuff in your head? Burying slaves alive, all kinds of, but they ran in this, in Leon Waters' book, the ads that slave owners would publish.
That's right.
My slave ran away. To be talking, but he was talking about women and how he that branded over the right breast, branded it. They would brand them as though they were branding animals.
And Earl, this is not anecdotal information either, because Leon Waters, how he came to this is because a great aunt of his told him, well, you know, we have family members that go back to the revolt in 1811 in Louisiana. And as a young boy, and as you heard Dred Scott telling part of that story, so he goes back to that period of time and then goes forward to today. And this book, and when I say this book, we're talking about the book On to New Orleans. I'm on the air right now with Earl Caldwell, formerly of the Caldwell Chronicle. But he's joining me today because he is instrumental in this story, because we did this together as a team. The book is called On to New Orleans, Louisiana's Heroic 1811 Slave Revolt, a brief history and documents relating to the rising of slaves in January 1811 in the territory of Orleans, by Albert Thrasher. Orleans, the territory of Orleans. It wasn't New Orleans at that time. It was the territory of Orleans. So he has the documents. And that's what I was saying. The documents are so important. Not anecdotal information from Leon's Aunt Kizzy that told him about this. No. They looked up all of this information, as you heard, some of it in French, some of it in English, these old documents, these court records, these tribunals after the insurrection was put down, and it was put down, brutally put down, but they had these tribunals, and it was written down meticulously. And this is only, and Leon Waters says that, he's the publisher of the book. He says, we don't have all the documents. There are things in people's archives locally here in New Orleans and in France that we don't have access to. But what we can get a hold of, we put in this book. It's a $60 contribution to WBAI on Living for the City, a $60 contribution by calling the pledge line at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. This, by the way, in case you don't know, this is a listener-sponsored radio station. It's not a commercial radio station. It's a commercially free radio station. That's why we can take this amount of time and flesh this story out. so that you can hear it and you can take advantage of supporting this radio station. This is just one program on a radio station with maybe 200 producers. We're having a fundraising drive. It's our spring fundraising drive, and we hope that we will do well, that you can get this book on to New Orleans. Just say it. On to New Orleans for a $60 contribution. Call the pledge line at 212-209-2950, or you can go online at give2wbai.org, give2wbai.org, and you can make your selections there. Now, in the book, in the beginning of the book, in the contents, I'm just going to give you some of the chapters. The 1811 commemoration, right now you're looking at dedicated to the martyrs of the 1811 slave revolt, the honor roll. And then the preface, notes on sources, the introduction, chapter 1, Africa. Chapter 2, the Haitian Revolution. Chapter 3, slavery in Louisiana. And it goes on. Down to January, talks about the January uprising, important dates, family legacy, and just so much. And until we get to the latter part of the book, the second part of the book, the slave revolt of 1811 and its aftermath. A, state and church. Government of the United States, President James Madison. Government of the Territory of Orleans, Governor William Charles Cole Claiborne. Secretary John Thomas B. Robertson. The Clerk J. Vasant. Delegate to Congress Julian Poydras. And it goes on. This is the book. If you want to get a publication for someone that's starting the university experience, their high school experience, for that matter, graduating from school, coming up, this is the book that you want to get. I made contact, Earl, with Leon Waters because I had been out of contact with him for a couple of years. And so general manager had been after me, Earl, to make a presentation of this again. But I said, no, I can't do it. I haven't been in contact with him. And we're out of books here. So I'm not going to do that until I make contact with Leon Waters and get some more books. I have done that. I have more books. And we're standing by to make more purchases of the books to share with all of you. The number again is 212-209-2950. This expanded edition of Living for the City during this fundraiser. Earl?
Michael, I'd just like to say, you know, when I say a great gift to their sons and daughters, I watch these students. When I went to Hampton, The newspaper was the newspaper. And 5 years later, the kids they wouldn't even read the newspaper. We couldn't give it to them.
Right.
During the pandemic, when we had to communicate with the students in a different way, I was able to then see what these kids were, what they were getting. They know how to film stories. They know how to edit the film. Mm-hmm. They know yes, how they to do. Bring it all together.
Yeah.
And they can do it with their own. I challenged this. I said, well, what did you do? I did everything. I said, well, you couldn't. No, you couldn't. And the student told me, he said, if anybody knows anything about the Scripps Howard School of Journalism, knows that you can't graduate if you're not proficient.
Yeah, that's right.
In
proficient
Final Cut Pro editing.
That's right.
I mean, they have these skills to take this to another level. And this is so important because now in this country, and there's not the outrage against it. This is the era of shutting down and taking out, banning books. I mean, they're saying you cannot tell these stories. These kids are going to make films. They're going to make documentaries. They're going to bring all this back. And what's so powerful too, Michael, when you, the first thing you talked about is the Africa and the Haiti, the connection. People don't realize how Haiti is connected to every bit of this American thing.
That's right.
You know, it's so powerful. But you, here's Harvard with these enormous resources. And the Harvard guy, what his thing was, he sanitized the story. He sanitized it. And he had to put Leon Waters' name in it because Leon Waters told him he wasn't going to even deal with him. And that's where he made your mistake, because that's when people like Michael G. Haskins say, hey, put on the traveling gear and go to New Orleans and get it and bring it back. And it's been introduced to this audience. And it is like wildfire. Anybody, you get it, it's life changing. This is more than a book. This is a document chock full of truth.
It truly is.
That's an example of why the history is so powerful and so important, the way it energizes and organizes and brings us up to realize power that we have that is ours in these stories. And this new generation, they can take it to another level because all of this new media that people wonder, how can we use it? What is that? They understand it. And to understand the power of it. This is, there's nothing that excites me more than being able to bring this story to New Yorkers. In the wide reach that WBAI has, it's possible to reach so many. But I hope that people will realize this is the biggest bargain. This is the most wonderful, important thing you can do, not only for yourself, but for your children, grandchildren. If you don't have children, the kids next door.
Yeah, that's
generation.
That's true. That's very
and
true.
We are on the early stages yet of being able to take this history that people are doing. Oh, people are organizing as we speak how they can stop us and shut this door to this history.
That's right.
To this authentic history. And we can see the route to take it to another level.
And that's why this radio station is so important. Not necessarily this program. This is one program of many, a very diverse radio station, WBAI. But because of that diversity, we are able to make these kinds of presentations. We have all kinds of interests, of producers, and I want to also acknowledge the work of Catherine Davis, the program coordinator for this membership drive, and working with the different producers and bringing them together and shepherding them through many of them, their first fundraising drive. But this is how it's done, folks. You gather your information, you present it, and you hope that your listenership, your audience will respond. And I'm hopeful that you are responding. You will respond to us today. I'm on the air with Earl Caldwell. Some of you know Earl very, very well, have been reading Earl for years. He was down at Hampton University for, was it 20 years, Earl? That's a minute.
Listen, the Chinese inspire you. Michael, one other thing, though. You know, we're focusing on this piece of history. But it's not just the black history. This is, when they say that we got to stop this history, it's the Hispanic, the Asian, the Native American, the Jewish history.
Yep.
We are in a crisis period in this nation, and we better not sleep it.
No.
It's a reason they're saying. and they're openly saying, ban these books, stop this flow of information. And we have to respond. We have to let our children know that we understand. And I think this is a great day for WBAI because we could get the opportunity to shine another big light on something that is so important.
Well, you know, Earl, the book again is on to New Orleans. Earl Caldwell, my friend, and I produced and helped produce the Caldwell Chronicle for many years at WBAI's location when we were at 120 Wall Street. And I'm so delighted to have Earl with me today talking about these issues. I was at a long stint at Hampton University, played a critical role in getting the new, brand new Scripps Howard School of Journalism and Communications up and running. He's working on his own archives now and looking to the future of journalism that Earl was just talking about. These young people can do it now. They can do it. They really can. But we're talking about the book On to New Orleans, Louisiana's Heroic 1811 Slave Revolt. It's just $60. When we originally presented it, it was a $100 contribution. We had all other audio to present for $60. We'll send this to you as a thank you gift. That's it. A thank you gift to you for supporting WBAI. Now, I want to read something from another book. And I hadn't read this book at the time because it hadn't been published at the time. It's by Gerald Horn, a very well-known historian, certainly here in the United States, well, internationally, no question about that. But his book, Confronting Black Jacobins, The United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. Gerald Horn is an American historian who holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. Just let me read a part of this to put this in context. You will probably, in Charleston, have an inundation of those worthy Creoles fleeing in panic, as had happened in Hispaniola, it was said. But those worthy Creoles, or at least their relatives in Paris, contributed to press for reestablishment of the French slave trade, as if the Haitian Revolution carried no dispositive lessons. Near the same time, slave traders in Manhattan, who had plied their ugly trade previously and murderously in Hispaniola, were organizing as if they were mechanics, forming a guild, while their salaciously bitter sarcasm betrayed an understandable unease about the future of this profession in light of the Haitian Revolution. Sardonic musings could not hide the point that the revolution had wounded a lucrative, albeit barbarous, slavery with the visionary now able to foresee the terminal phase of the entire system. Helping to illuminate this new reality were the frequent hemispheric flames now leaping more regularly at the behest of newly energized Africans. The 1811 revolt in Louisiana, generally viewed as one of the most significant and largest on the mainland, was seen as being stimulated by Haiti. Not least since the presumed leaders were viewed as having participated in analogous rebellions in Hispaniola before arriving on the mainland. Only by the narrowest of margins, said one astute observer, have the state escaped a repetition of the brutal and sanguinary scenes which had marked the servile revolt in Haiti. Like a number of revolts of the enslaved, this one too was inspired by the island revolutionaries. Also, like many slave revolts, this one too was felt far away. St. Louis, in this case, and not surprisingly, since the Mississippi River, replete with frequent boat traffic, was linked directly to New Orleans, punctuating the impact of the island on the mainland, was the curious occurrence that the man who ordered the execution by firing squad of the perpetrators of the 1811 rebellion was a refugee from the slaveholding class of Hispaniola. That is in Gerald Horn's book, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. We are offering you now, that's just an excerpt from this book, we're offering you On to New Orleans, Louisiana's Heroic 1811 Slave Revolt, and the number to call is 212-209-2950, a $60 pledge to WBAI. We will send you this book as a thank you gift. Now, we only have, you know, less than an hour, 40 minutes or so, to encourage you to support the program and support the radio station. The number is 212-209-2950. Let us hear from you. Let us hear from you right now. Make the call in support of WBAI. This connection. Did you hear the connection that Gerald Horn pointed out? The connection to Haiti. The people in the United States, the government of the United States, knew very well about Haiti and the potential of revolt and revolution here in the United States. Let us hear from you now. We'll take just a brief pause. 212-209-2950. $60 pledge for On to New Orleans, Louisiana's Heroic 1811 Slave Revolt. This is Living for the City over WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. This expanded edition of, you know, Earl, I almost said the Caldwell Chronicle. This is Living for the City because it's taking me back to our time when we were together in studio long before COVID shut down everything, when, you know, we were in the studio together. We had Leon Waters here, and I think the general manager then, and now, but the general manager, Bertolt Reimers, who did understand the importance of bringing Leon Waters
into the station. He thought this was a good idea as well. I was convinced that the audience would respond. The Caldwell audience would respond, and they did. Do you know, Earl, we rebroadcast this until we ran out of books. We had cases of books up here in New York at Wall Street, and we played the presentations over and over again until we, in fact, ran out of books. So I'm very pleased with that effort, how the audience responded.
Said, Michael, this is authentic. This is real. And it says that way of resonating. And I think people understand the importance. And it's even more so now as we see what is taking place in this country. This is it's a bargain. It's a wonderful bargain, and it's wonderful that WBAI takes this moment to give people something that it's a precious, it is truly precious. And I congratulate you for taking it, the extra time to do it. And from the very beginning, you, to me, were the one that took it to another level. You saw what it was, and you didn't just say, wow, it stopped there. That energized you. And the next thing I know, you were in New Orleans. You were talking directly with these people and looking at understanding, the whole struggle of trying to bring this important history, American history, and way it connects with Haiti and the Dominican Republic and New York City. People also forget how the Haitians came up here when America was fighting its revolution. Mm. Haitians came up here fighting on Long Island for the Americans. And, you know, it gets forgotten. Of course, now Haiti needs America's help, and America, they've even forgotten the name of Haiti. But, you know, these things that come around will go around, and people are... Yeah, is it, what's that? Do we say every closed eye ain't sleep? Every goodbye ain't gone. But yes, I would say that the day will make a statement about this whole piece of American history that will be unprecedented for WBAI, because this is the one station that has a strong voice that is. Stood strong to tell these stories not told, as you say, to delve into this hidden history. And so this is a chance for people also to support that the station. You must have that support. You can't go forward without it. And this is an excellent moment, and it's the right issue, because right now in this country, we are, and you know, these people don't want to burn all these books, take this history out, forbid the young generation to even know about these things. They're just getting started. So people have to understand that, mobilize and build the other side, because this is our freedom we're fighting for.
Absolutely.
This is what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah, and we can do it.
I honor Michael, you've given me today that opportunity to join you. I appreciate it.
Oh, yes. No, it is my pleasure having you, because, as I said initially, you were an integral part of the story. I knew that we had this vehicle of the Caldwell Chronicle, your program, and you allowed him. And that back then, we had a 3-hour block of time. Hugh Hamilton had a 3-hour block of time to do these long form programs. And 3 hours is a long time. 2 hours is a long time to be on the radio. But it took that amount of time. It took at least 50 minutes for Leon Waters to tell the story about his family history, about the fact that his
aunt told him as a young boy about this connection to this slave revolt. When you're 10 years old, you don't know anything about any slave revolt. You're running around in the street playing ball, stickball, basketball, whatever you're doing. You don't think about that. But as you get older, you think about it. You go through your life experiences and you remember what your great aunt told you. And that's what Leon Waters did. And we made the connection. We made the connection to Leon Waters. And I was listening last night to some of the recordings that I made with Leon when I was down in Louisiana visiting him, taking the tour. And I should say, you know, if anyone goes to New Orleans, Louisiana, and you have a couple of days, you should get in contact with him at Hidden History Tours. That's Hidden History Tours, Leon A. Waters. You will get more information about this issue and about the history of New Orleans in general and their struggles there, their struggles around police issues. Well, every community has struggles around police issues and excessive use of force. But what they're doing down there, very, very active community. We're asking you, those of you listening right now, those of you who have been listening or were listening to the representation that Dred Scott made, to make a call in support of Living for the City on WBAI. The name of the book that I'm offering today is entitled On to New Orleans, Louisiana's Heroic 1811 Slave Revolt, a $60 contribution by calling 212-209-2950. You can pledge online at give2wbai.org. give2wbai.org. Now we're in the spring fundraising and membership drive. We're putting together, compiling all of the information from our archives, the people that you've listened to over the years, and currently we have the best of WBAI on a flash drive for $99. Some of the voices that you've heard for years. Some have joined the ancestors. Some are with us and producing and hosting and bringing wonderful programs today. Janet Coleman, David Dozer, Max Schmid, Golden Age of Radio, Cat Radio Cafe, Janet and David, Hour of the Wolf, Jim Freund, David Kenny, Everything Old is New Again. We're bringing Samori Marksman, Ilambe Brath, Basir M. Chawi, Mimi Rosenberg, Delphine Blue. I'm sure there will be some of the music that music programs that Delphine Blue produced over the years will be on that flash drive. So many, the late, recently passed Tony Ryan as well. 212-209-2950. The best of WBAI on a flash drive. That's a $99 contribution. It is also a thank you gift to you for supporting WBAI. I have another item that I'd like to share with you, and I want to do that before we run out of time, because in this last 35, 40 minutes of the program before we have to make way for the next program goes by very, very quickly. So I want to bring this to you right now. And Earl had mentioned it, and we were talking about how they're banning books in this country. And some kind of, we can't have this history told. And I want to share this excerpt right now. It's a commencement at Morehouse College just in the past few days, yesterday or a couple of days ago, the commencement at Morehouse College, and the governor of Maryland gave the commencement address. The Maryland governor, black, only black governor we have in this country right today. So I want to play that, a little bit of that commencement for you to just give an additional flavor of what we're talking about and the importance of getting this book and supporting this radio station, WBAI.
Morehouse, I stand before you as the first black governor of my state and only the third black governor ever to be elected in the history of this country with a very simple message. Our history is our power. And I've come to tell you this, that we have got to hold our history close. Because life will test you. And when it does, your history will give you the power to meet the challenge. Because out in the world, people will seek to minimize your history. Out in the world, people will seek to rewrite your history. Out in the world, many people will seek to have you forget your history. I look around the country and I see book banning. I'm looking around the country right now and I'm seeing people being censored, teachers being censored. I see curriculum of truth being taken out. This is not just a threat to our history, it is a threat to our strength. When politicians ban books and muzzle educators, they say it's an effort to prevent discomfort and guilt. But we know that's not true. This is not about a fear of making people feel bad. It is about a fear of people understanding their power. This is a fear of you realizing that you come from a long line of titans, of visionaries, of dreamers, of pioneers, of people who defied the odds and helped build this nation with their hands, their hearts, and their minds. And what is happening now with our history? It's just the beginning. I fear we are watching the early decay of a deep rot that threatens to hollow out our future by eliminating our past. Those who yearn to destroy history will not stop at our history. They will go after the history of those we know too. I'm talking about our friends in the indigenous community. I'm talking about our friends in the Jewish community. I'm talking about our friends in the Asian community. I'm talking about our friends in the gay community. I'm talking about our mothers and daughters and our sisters. I'm talking about everybody in this country who has ever been a part of the American story. And who we are watching the stories of those who came before us be wiped away. A threat to any history is a threat to all history.
Our history is our power. Governor Wes Moore's address at Morehouse College 2023, a long line of visionaries and dreamers. Earl, that was a powerful presentation that the governor of Maryland made.
And that his voice is that it struck me, Michael, when I was listening to that, you introduced me to it. And I had read about him, his election, but I hadn't really heard him. I didn't really know him. I was stunned that he won that election. Mm. His voice is resonating in a way that we have. I'm saying that I have not heard since we first heard the voice of Barack Obama. I believe this is a new, powerful voice on the American scene. And carrying some very powerful messages. I'm very excited about this new governor. I'm hoping I'll get a chance to talk to him in the near future. And I think that message that a threat to people's history anywhere, that threat is everywhere, and it is powerful.
You know, Earl,
again, are to be congratulated, Michael G. Haskins, because you have a feel for this. This resonates with you, and you know what to do with it. You bring it to the great WBAI audience. That's Michael G. Haskins, and that's your history.
Well,
and
Earl, I knew right away when I heard it, and when I was talking about WBAI before, and my feelings about the station and community nature, or maybe the lack of it that I see. This is a prime example. This came to me from the community right up there in Mount Vernon, New York. And as soon as I heard it, I said, got to be on the program. And that's the connection between the community and people. I've heard people over the years here be, I poo-poo, oh, the community. No, the community is key, in my opinion. In my experience, to this radio station.
Yes, it's always been, Michael. It's always come through in all of your work. And I congratulate you again today. And I'm sure that resonates with the audience, too. They understand that you have fought so hard for these stories, for this, to shed light on this hidden history, which you brought back from Leon Waters. I congratulate you. You have really stood strong. And you know, those who stand up for these things now, you put yourselves in a way for a lot to come back at you, but you've shown that you're not afraid, and you will stand up for this. And I congratulate you, and I'm sure the members of the audience are going to congratulate you, and the way they do it is calling in today and responding to this premium that you're offering, this very timely and very important piece of history. And we stand with you, Michael.
Oh, well, thank you, Earl. Yes, and I hope that the listeners are responding. A $60 contribution to WBAI by calling our pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. You don't have this book? We will send you this book as a thank you gift. And, you know, I've done things in the past where I said, well, listen, I'm not going to run it through the station because I want to make sure that you are going to get it. So I'm going to give my email address out. Well, that's not really working out too well. I have these books, and I will bring them to the station so we can give them to you. The number is 212-209-2950, a $60 pledge. It's a thank you gift. That's all it is. You're not buying the book. You're contributing to WBAI so that we can bring journalists like Earl Caldwell and the other guests that I bring on to these airways with Jillian Jonas. But this is my passion. Those of you who have listened to me, as I said initially in the beginning of this program, know that I bring and I have brought for some years now the stories of my father to these airwaves. I said to my father, and actually right around the time that I'd gone to New Orleans, but a few years before that, my father was getting up in age, and I said, Dad, I remember you telling me as a boy, make the connection now between Leon Waters and his aunt. I remember you telling me the stories as a boy of what it was like growing up in Depression-era Virginia. In the Old Dominion, what it was like, Jim Crow,
what was that? And he told me the stories. And it's, the stories are so rich. And I have this platform, WBAI, to bring some of those stories to you. This is my passion, and I am committed to doing that. And thank you all for supporting me and allowing me to do this, to continue to do it. So we're asking you right now, please make that call in support of Living for the City on WBAI. I'm Michael G. Haskins. I don't know, you know, what's happening with the number of books. Have anybody called in to make a contribution? Have anybody called in to get the flash drive, the best of WBAI, on a flash drive for $99? That's available. We're in a membership drive now, and we need everybody to step forward. We need everybody to do what they can. If you listen to this program regularly and you haven't made a contribution in the past year or 6 months, would you do so right now? We only have a few minutes to go before we close in on the top of the hour. And Earl, thank you so much for giving your time and being with me. I know that you have a number of other things. You got so many things to unpack and organize and continue your writing and your scholarship, but you've given 2 hours of your day to me based on our long-time relationship, and I really appreciate that and honor you, Earl. I really do. We've had a lot of experiences over the year, and I'm, you know, I'm the richer for it, for sure.
Michael, I get a lot of good and positive energy for you. Your work inspires me. You bring so much to the table, and you're not afraid to do the work. You do the work. And so it's an honor for me to be with you on this special day, carrying this special message and feeling, and I hope that the audience will feel the urgency in all of this. And remember this, there's not many places on the whole dial now. We're in a crisis with solid information in this country. And so the fundraising drives are always important, but it's crucial now because we are in a very difficult period. And these threats to in the flow of information, they keep growing. They keep growing. So it's important that BAI be in a strong position because you've got some very strong winds that are blowing against what the station stands for. So I hope that people will respond today to Michael G. and that message and make this support real. Thank you so much, Michael. It's been my pleasure to be with you this morning.
Thank you, Earl. Thank you so very, very much. Earl Caldwell with me on, and I I have to resist saying the Caldwell Chronicle. I am sorry. Please forgive me, folks, and Jillian as well. On Living for the City, I'm so used to saying and being with Earl on the Caldwell Chronicle on these fundraising drives. Please forgive me. But this is Living for the City over WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you, Earl. I appreciate you being on the line with me this day, this special expanded edition of Living for the City. There's another thing that's going on, a national speaking tour. Look at this, called Woke Lunacy versus Real Revolution with Sunsara Taylor and Rafael Cadaris. It's starting in California, and they'll be screening this presentation in Harlem next Tuesday, May 30th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Books. It's controversial talk, but I think there's no one better suited, one of the best to talk about this than
Sansara Taylor. Woke is a destructive force in the political, intellectual, artistic, and ethical life of society. Woke lunacy is paralyzing and intimidating decent people who should be fighting back. It is providing fresh fodder for fascists to viciously attack every cry for justice. Sansara Taylor and Rafael Cadaris, next Tuesday, the 30th of May at 7 p.m. So you want to find out more information, just look up revbooks.com, R-E-V, revbooks.com, Revolution Books. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to make a contribution in support of WBAI. I'll share a little bit more of, of Dred Scott's presentation of the recreation event down in New Orleans. I mean, it just overwhelms me listening to him talk about the people of the community. We had people in the New Orleans community. I mean, you know, it wasn't anything that he did spontaneously. He worked at this and brought the folks together, brought them together, and they went throughout the city and they, you know, talked to city fathers and said, well, you know, this is what we need and this is what we are doing. So we'll share a little bit more of that before we close out the program today. But don't forget the book, On to New Orleans, Louisiana's Heroic 1811 Slave Revolt, the largest slave revolt, the largest revolt of enslaved Africans in the history of the United States. 212-209-2950, a $60 pledge to WBAI.
What you would say to them? Did you have to talk to people that that were in, let's say, in control of a said area, city leaders or whatever, and tell them that this is what you were doing and what you were proposing? Did they have any objections? Were the people curious? Take us on that story.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a community engaged artwork. This project couldn't be done in any other way, and I wouldn't want to. I mean, sure, you could possibly do a movie with just hiring a bunch of extras, and that would be cool, but that's not what this was. This was a community-engaged project, and it really involved, you know, spending a lot of time in New Orleans, meeting the people that are the key stakeholders, people like Leon Waters, but also activists in that community, people who lived right in the area, pastors and religious, you know, clergy that were civic leaders in some ways, city council people and parish council people, artists that were in the area, and talking with them. And as you said earlier, it's like a lot of people both don't know that history, and even those that do, they don't know who Dred Scott, this artist from New York, is. So there was a lot of conversations that had to happen to get people to trust that I was not going to abuse the history, that I was not going to steal the history, that I was not going to do something that was harmful to them. I mean, some of the people really liked the idea, but were like, look, Dred, this is a brilliant idea, But we live down here. Mm. You got to understand, this is Klan country. Mm. When they did desegregation in the schools, the white people set up a different school. Yeah. You know, when the black people forced their way into that, then the white people were like, okay, well, our mascot's going to be the rebel, you know, and we're going to have the Confederate flag as our symbol. And that was not like in 1955. That was in 1989 or 1990.
Yeah, Leon tells me that those struggles are still taking place to this day.
Well, and, you know, after we built up a group of people that wanted to participate, and I could talk more about that project, but, you know, when this was going to happen, when 350 people had signed up to do this, they didn't know all the details. I said, look, we're going to be staying overnight in the town of Norco, which the town of Norco is right near this oil refinery, New Orleans Refinery Corporation, that's run by Shell, and it's part of Cancer Alley, and it's poisoning people. Yeah. And those areas are really segregated. There's the black part of Norco and the white part of Norco. But when I told some of the people who lived down there that, hey, we're going to be staying overnight in Norco, and there was a church that had welcomed us, and we're going to let us, like, there was a former Catholic school and was going to let us stay there. And some of the people were like, "Dred, I don't know if this is going to be all right, man. There's serious racists up there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, first of all, it's going to be all right. We've done the work to make sure it's safe. Mm-hmm. We have a whole plan about safety and security. But, you know, David Duke, former head of the Ku Klux Klan, ran for governor and got a significant, sizable portion of the vote. He's still a public figure down there. This is Klan country. Right. It's also a country that has a lot of other kind of, you know, people in it. And so that's not the defining character, but, you know, it's, and, you know, I thought that it was really important. One of the things that white supremacists do, I mean, they do kill people. They are dangerous, but their bark is more fearsome than their bite. Mm-hmm. And if you let them determine, oh, we can't come in here, we can't do a slave rebellion, we can't honor this history, this revolutionary radical history, because we might upset some white people and they might actually come and attack us, then they've won. Dang. And so my approach was, no, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like black people fighting for freedom and emancipation and unity with some indigenous people, because indigenous people also participated in the 1811 revolt. Mm-hmm. That's something that's inspiring. It should be inspiring. It's a powerful history. And I went to people with that. It's like, look, you want to get free? Let's get with this. If you want to embody freedom and emancipation, let's get with this. And then there were a lot of questions about, well, how is this art? What kind of art is it? Are you going to organize the people? How are we going to raise funding? Are we going to get paid? Where are we going to stay? Mm-hmm. All sorts of questions. Mm-hmm. But it was on the basis of, like, let's get free. Let's actually talk about this history of 1811. Why does this history of a rebellion in 1811 matter to 21st century people? Why does this 19th century history matter to people in the present? And then on that basis, a lot of people had a lot to say. And some people, you know, who were virtually homeless really wanted to participate because they thought this was a system that you know, was, you know, stolen their homes and was treating them like dirt. And they actually had a lot to say. Other people had family members that participated, great-great-grandparents that were part of the revolt in 1811, who drove a long way. I was totally touched when I heard that the aunt and uncle of Oscar Grant were getting on a plane from Oakland and wanted to come to town to participate in this rebellion and walk 26 miles with us. There were people that were, you know, Pastor Donald August and his wife Rita, you know, they wanted to participate because, I'm forgetting her name, it's not Rita, but she grew up in the Woodland Quarters, which was right where this rebellion started. But the Woodland Quarters are now a poor section. Basically, they were, you know, the slave cabins in 1811, and were continued to be used as sharecropping. And so she grew up in this poor neighborhood in Laplace. They wanted to participate because they thought that history was really important for people in the area to know. And so, you know, there was a lot of work to, you know, a lot of town hall meetings and sewing circles to make the costumes and conversations with people about why this history matters. But on that basis, then a lot of people threw in and really wanted to participate. And it was, you know, it was an amazing event that all sorts of people felt that they embodied a spirit that didn't exist, or most people didn't know that existed, that was, they felt was really important to bring into the present. Thank you.
Fred Ho, Free New Africa, Boogaloo. Living for the city over WBAI 99.5 FM, and read an excerpt from the book Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic by Gerald Horn. Gerald Horn is an American historian who holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. Reading some of Gerald's book for context about the 1811 slave revolt, and the book that myself and Earl Caldwell have been talking about for the hour and a half that we've been on the air together is On to New Orleans, Louisiana's Heroic 1811 Slave Revolt, a $60 pledge, tax-deductible pledge to WBAI at 212-209-2950. I hope that you're making a call, making a pledge to the station. I have not heard from our folks here at WBAI, whether any books have been selected by you, but I hope that has been the case. I would like to make a announce your name on the air, but you can make that contribution to WBAI. Do it right now. Make a contribution right now. $60 pledge to WBAI. We'll send you this book as a thank you gift. Or you could become a sustaining member, a BAI buddy. How about that? A buddy is someone like you. Like you, that would make a contribution. It could be the $60 contribution. You want to do that. Just a one-time contribution. But if you want to be that BAI buddy, you can say, all right, I'll donate, I'll contribute $20 a month to WBAI. If you have. If you're on fixed income, of course, we're not asking for that. And why is that? Because there are so many others driving around New York City, coming into the city on the Long Island Railroad or New Jersey Transit, however you're making your way around the city or leaving the city to go to New Jersey, Long Island, Connecticut, that can make the pledge for those people that depend upon the radio that are on fixed income. So I'm asking those of you that can, you in Connecticut or you in parts of Pennsylvania that pick up this signal terrestrially, to make the call in support of WBAI. We only have a couple of minutes left. 212-209-2950. I got to get some water. I'm tired. I need to hear from you to see your calls of support. Back in the time that we did this before, you would hear phones ringing all the time. People were calling up, making pledges, getting these books. This book today is for a $60 contribution, full of these, of the narrative by Albert Thrasher and the documents. The documents is so key in the research and the presentation. Court documents relating to the 1811 revolt from New Orleans by the city court. New Orleans Courier, January 14th, 1811. Now, the revolt happened on the 8th. It was put down, and they had the tribunals, the persons who have arrested the following slaves or who were present when they were arrested are invited to make themselves known and to communicate either verbally or by writing to the judge of the parish of New Orleans any information which they might have respecting those individuals as having participated in the last insurrection, principally to know in what place they were arrested. This, it's just have territory of New Orleans versus Negro John. What else do we have? Territory versus Elaine or Neptune. The Negroes, Etienne or Neptune or Jerry or, what is this, Gurry. The slaves of James Fortier and Jean, a Negro boy. You see, what is important and significant to me is that these documents, these court documents, the tribunals, this is not anecdotal information. And as I said before, as Leon Waters pointed out, there are documents in Louisiana, in old plantation homes, that they don't and none of us will ever have access to. The same thing in France. We will never have access, but they exist. And part of it, part of the story, is in this book. On to New Orleans, Louisiana's heroic 1811 slave revolt. Make your calls now. Support Living for the City on WBAI. Call up right now and make a contribution in support of WBAI. Call the pledge line right now. We're waiting. I'm waiting to see some kind of information that from you all that you have called and made a pledge. Would you do that? 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Africa, Africa, ayaw niya yun. Yeah. Much for listening to this past program, a special edition of Living for the City or WVAI. I hope you made a contribution, a call in support of the program, and have picked up the book, ordering the book, selecting the book, asking for the thank you gift of On to New Orleans, Louisiana's Heroic 1811 Slave Revolt. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time. Remember to surround yourself with people who respect and treat you well.
And without that tower, we can't stay on the air.
Please, just give what you can.
And those kinds-
contributions can be small or they can be large, but those are the contributions that we need to make in order to beat back the other side. No one is going to do it for us.
Even a few dollars a month helps to keep us on the air.
Let's face it, without Pacifica, what do you have? NPR is too milquetoast. PBS, too milquetoast. Without Pacifica, we're dead in the water.
And that pledge line is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950.
And we're only asking those who can give it, those who can afford it. We know that there's some people out there who cannot afford it, and that's one of the problems. Those of us who relatively have must stand up for those who have not.
I'm sick and tired hearing people complain about, well, you know, the right wing has Fox News and they have this and they have that. The oppressor always has more money than the oppressed. We have to make use of the resources that we have. We have people and we have people that can make contributions.
Here on WBAI 99.5 FM, we want to have the Tower Fund strong and healthy so we're not worried about it.
212-209-2950. Or you can go online at WBAI.org and donate to the Tower Fund.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a celebration. The award-winning Midnight Ravers can now be heard every Friday from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. So wake the town and tell the people. We'll continue to present the best in music, history, and social commentary, along with expert discussion of the important issues and events of today and yesteryear. So keep it locked into WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.